created a world where we leave nobody behind, that we have irreversibly eradicated poverty in a more sustainable and equitable way. It is within our means, it is within our reach, it is within our capabilities, but it starts with us. Do we care? Do we have the willpower?
Hey, Lightwolf community out there. Do you recognize this wonderful voice? This is Stefan Hohmeister. Hello and welcome to today's Lightwolf podcast entitled Accelerating Sustainable Change. And today I have the huge pleasure to have another conversation with one of the most impactful global business and sustainable development leaders on this planet. It's my pleasure to welcome Paul Polman. Paul, I'm so grateful that you're kind enough to again grant us some of your precious time in the name of about 23,000 people in the Lightwolf community, and today probably many more. Welcome to the Lightwolf podcast.
Well, thank you for having me once more, and congratulations on now having 23,000 followers. And with the situation that we find ourselves in the world, we need all of you. So that's why I'm here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Awesome. Dear Lightwolf, Paul is chair of Imagine, a social venture mobilizing business leaders around tackling climate change and global inequality. And I know how important these topics are to Paul's heart. Paul is honorary chair of the International Chamber of Commerce, chair of the B Team and SAID Business School, and vice chair of the UN Global Compact. Under Paul's leadership, 10 years as CEO, the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan aimed at doubling the growth, halving the environmental impact, and tripling the social impact. The results demonstrate that a long-term multi-stakeholder model goes hand in hand with excellent financial performance. And Paul, I vividly remember last time, 1.5 years ago, we met face to face. You showed me your chart with the 300% total shareholder return on a decade. That's just a stunning result. Yeah. Paul was also a member of the UN Secretary General's high-level panel, which developed the Sustainable Development Goals, and continues to work with global organizations and across industries to push the 2030 development agenda. Paul, your goals, your global goals in tackling climate change and global inequality, and my personal passion to make good leadership commonplace in the world, they connect in at least three places. They connect in acceleration, in sustainability and change. And therefore, today's title, Accelerating Sustainable Change. Now, when I prepared for this interview, I read a recent Forbes interview that you gave, and you cited an impressive example of accelerating sustainable change by bringing together courageous leaders around a common good cause. You brought together leaders from Pepsi, Coke, Nestle, and Unilever, running businesses that together account for more than 20% of all refrigerators used in these industries. If they convert their HFC and CFC gases with natural refrigerants, this will help the planet a lot. And you know, as I do, it's nice to think about these things. It's important to talk about these things, but the key is to act. And that's what you do. And my question to you is, Paul, how did you make these CEOs meet, discuss, and take action?
Well, that's a very good question, Stefan. And this is a typical example where you need to have what I would call pre-competitive space. Nobody is buying a beverage from a beverage machine or an ice cream from an ice cream cabinet based on the engine that is in there. Yet, unfortunately, we have the engines currently emitting HFC or CFC, that you know is quite detrimental to the environment. In fact, collectively, these cooling cabinets account for about 3% of global warming. That's not a good thing. We can't afford it. We've seen the results of that with COVID once more. So one of the things we said was, what is needed to drive a tipping point in the industry? It happens to be, at that time I was Warren Nestle as chief financial officer, that if you put Nestle together, if you put Unilever together on ice cream, if you put Pepsi and Coke together on the beverages, that you get a critical mass, about 20-25% of these cabinets. So none of us can individually find an alternative because you need to change industry standards. We found that in some governments needed to change actually laws, believe it or not. But if we would go together and attack this issue like an issue of humanity versus a competitive issue. We could put a relatively small amount together for research to find an alternative and then leverage that across the industry. And this is exactly what happened. It took us about 3 years to work together to find an alternative, to develop a supplier, to create an engine with natural refrigerants, and obviously then have a 10-year rollout plan. Not every cabinet can be scrapped today to build a new one. That would be detrimental to the environment as well. But planning it properly. So Unilever's 3 million ice cream cabinets are more or less converted now. Coke and Pepsi are on their way. Nestle started implementing it. And what we then saw, not surprisingly, was others in the industry jumping on it, wanting to be part of it, or starting to think about conversions themselves, and that is happening. What we found also as a coincidence, that by working together, we spread the risk, we found alternative suppliers, we scaled up, and we ended up with engines that were cheaper than what we were using before and were better for the environment. So it's a typical example of creating a win-win by putting some of this competitive space aside and working for the future of humanity. I couldn't find a better example of that.
Yeah, it's an awesome example. Out of interest, Paul, did you have to face any challenges, any obstacles in convincing people to join this and act?
Well, interestingly, believe it or not, I had to go to Brussels because I was sort of putting this coalition together, having talked to the other CEOs who right away agreed, by the way, that was the positive thing. But I had to go to Brussels. Almunia at that time was the commissioner for competition. And you know how tense that environment is, that anytime you see a competitor with another competitor in the room, the red flags go up. So we actually had to change the European competitive laws and say, hey, we have to share information about the number of cabinets, about the requirements. We are going to jointly develop and perhaps jointly buy. And that needed a very clear understanding and a commitment also from Europe. And then, interestingly and surprisingly to me, the U.S. had a very strong lobby on the HFC and CFC. As you know, the U.S. has not signed the Montreal Accord or the Kigali Agreement, which actually covered these things quite extensively. Now with President Biden, we hope that they come back in, but it still hasn't happened. So the U.S. had quite archaic laws and quite heavy lobbying from some parts of the industries that actually said, well, we cannot use these natural refrigerants. So at that time, Lisa Jackson, who now is the sustainability officer for Apple, a wonderful lady, was actually running the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. And so I remember coming into her humongous office, walking half an hour to find her desk. And she was surprised that we were there, but immediately bought into it. So the fact that we caught her under a Democratic government, Obama in office, I think helped a little bit. And we were able to change that. So these were the two bigger hurdles. And then the third one is that you normally expect, you get some free riders, people that start to heavily advertise this initiative, but don't do anything themselves. We've seen that on deforestation, and we've seen it on other efforts on climate change or on now, diversity in the workplace. These people try to make commitments that are very far off, so nobody can attack them, but they have a hard time to implement it themselves and hide behind progress that the industry makes. So those ones you have to shake loose, you have to call them out, you have to put a little bit of positive pressure on them to have them join, and then the critical mass builds, and ultimately it leads to a tipping point.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for sharing this. I'm really particularly noteworthy that the CEOs were relatively easy to convert. They wanted to buy in fast, but there were other obstacles around. And I like your description of the guys you have to shake from the trees who want to talk but not really act. Interesting. Now, building on this, related to it, but slightly different topic, in the same interview though, in your Forbes interview, you also said a sentence that made me again stop and reflect about another key ingredient of success, happiness, purpose, and change. You said, look for quote unquote whole people instead of quote unquote half people. What does that term mean to you, Paul?
Well, I think we all go through certain stages of life. And even in my early part of my career, I was very concentrated on building my career, getting a certain level of financial security, ensuring that the company or institution you work for, at that time P&G, would appreciate the work and reward you with broader responsibilities and increased financial security, if you want to. And that's a period of life that you might be a little bit self-centered. Self-centered doesn't necessarily mean yourself, but it might mean your family, providing security, having a roof above their heads and all the other things. And it takes a certain concentration and a certain attention span that goes into that direction. But you only become a whole person the moment you discover in life that you're not here for yourself, that you're actually here to serve others. The leadership really starts when you know that by investing in others, you're ultimately also better off yourself. Some people have called that level 5 leadership, but I think it goes well beyond that nowadays. The Dalai Lama said when he said that if you seek enlightenment just for yourself to enhance your own benefits, you miss purpose. But if you seek enlightenment to help others achieve their objectives, you are with purpose. And ultimately, I think we have discovered that running a company with purpose, running your life with a deeper sense of purpose that is bigger than your immediate circle or your own self-interest, is actually a more rewarding life, a more successful life, and obviously a life worth living.
Yeah, it's a great example again. Now, in my area that I'm trying to drive, my vision is a world where every leader leads well and where every employee feels well led, Paul. And I see good examples, I see bad examples. I sometimes feel I probably have work for the next 500 years. But I'm pushing this and you're helping me. And of course, I think there is a strong relationship between being a half person or whole person and leadership. And like you say, some of that might just be natural. Because when I reflect about myself, when I was young, when I was in my early 30s, when I just had my first child, I also felt like you, like I have someone to take care for. And that's in my immediate environment. That's my family. So I cared for my family first. Still, my question to you is, have you found ways how you can make people want to turn themselves from a half person into a whole person and to become leaders helping others rather than just leaders helping themselves?
Yeah, in my moment was really when I worked for P&G and they sent me from Spain to Newcastle. I always was interested in the broader things in the world, involved in some of the activities as a family. In Spain, I was running Boy Scouts and having my kids involved and taking responsibilities. We were active in church. So it is not that you're oblivious from society. But only when I came to Newcastle, I saw the first time in my life second generation unemployment because of shipbuilding, steel, coal, all having gone belly up. You had a whole generation of people who never saw their parents having worked. They were basically living off the dole, as they would say it then. And the only thing a 14-year-old girl could get as their possession basically was being pregnant, making their own situations worse again. And thanks to my predecessor, Mike Clasper at that time, who came from Sunderland and was a local boy, as you might call it, he was heavily involved in the local community. P&G was the biggest employer there, so we had a seat on the university. We were working on a Newcastle initiative to regenerate the region. We were involved in helping the soccer club eradicate drugs because these people were enormous role models. So we would send them off to schools and all the other things. So in fact, he had so many activities going on that in the beginning, I had a hard time balancing my work for P&G with the work in the community. But soon I discovered that higher level of awareness that was created with that ability to engage was also directly beneficial in our business. You started to really understand why you were here. You put the consumer or citizen squarely in the middle and started to serve them in all you did. And you then discovered that you were actually very fortunate in the position that you were, and that you entirely had to dedicate yourself not to the internal struggles or one function versus another function or writing a million emails and think you're important, but entirely dedicate yourself in everything you do to these people out there that really need your help. We still live in a world where 4.5 billion people live on $5 or less a day. We still live in a world where 1.5 billion people don't have access to sanitation and have to do open defecation. We still live in a world where 826 million people go to bed hungry, not knowing if they wake up the next day. We still live in a world where 246 million children are excluded from education. So we will not be able to function individually or in our communities or as companies if we don't make this a more equitable, more sustainable, more inclusive world. And this is really that what this whole leadership is about, that you are there for something bigger than yourself.
Yeah. Striking example with young kids seeing their own parents never having been employed. I never thought about it that way, and you've seen it. And I know you well enough to know how much this must have touched you, Paul. I just wonder, I don't just want to wait with making leadership, good leadership, commonplace until everyone has seen these things. Maybe I have to, Paul, but I want to accelerate. I wonder what else I can do, what else those 23,000 people on this call can do in order to make leaders stop focusing so much on themselves, which I think is still the key reason. Let me cite just one simple example. You won't believe it, Paul. And I do it anonymous because I'm not here to blame any company. A good friend of mine has a 25-year-old daughter. She has just finished university end of June, started her first job on July the 1st on a huge company that anyone on this call knows well. And she gets into this COVID world where a Zoom fix with her boss, a weekly Zoom fix, has to happen via this medium that we are having this conversation in Zoom, so virtually. And believe it or not, Paul, for 5.5 months, just once, that boss opened the screen so that that girl could even see how her boss looked. A young 25-year-old looking for orientation, having dreams, having hopes, having fears. How can a leader be so insensitive to keep the frame shut in every single jaw fix?
Yeah, that is regrettable to hear, Stefan, and I know that happens and we all have our own experience in life. But when these experiences like that happen, we have to just learn from them. And interestingly, is those are the experiences that we don't forget. When people are surprisingly nice to us, we don't forget that either. But when people are neglect us and make us feel that we don't belong to, that we are not part of, which after all is a big human need, we feel that. We feel it internally and it hurts. But fortunately, what you now see more and more and more also is the younger generation, they want to work for companies that have a bigger purpose, not companies that are myopically focused on the shareholder and maximizing financial return, for example. But they also want to work for bosses, and it is always the immediate boss that has the biggest influence, where they feel they're being heard, they're being listened to, they're being valued for what they do, where there is a clear understanding of where it leads to the efforts that they're putting in. And I think over time, they will self-select, and these bosses that behave like that will actually marginalize themselves increasingly. What companies need to do is to work on cultures, which starts with values and behaviors that ultimately define these cultures, that are more open, that are more transparent, that are more welcoming, and obviously cultures where each and everybody can develop themselves to their fullest potential are cultures that are 10 times more successful long-term. We now can show with hard facts, which frankly, we didn't have 5 or 10 years ago when I started the journey with Unilever, but we now have hard facts that a more gender diverse organization performs better, that an organization that gives a higher voice to youth performs better. And that's quite normal, if you want to. An organization that has purpose at its core has a higher engagement amongst employees. So we are now able to translate everything into hard business results. And when you have individuals that don't get it, you either need to help them see the importance of it, and we all need that. We all have had the training on how to have tough conversations or how to motivate others. So organizations have an obligation to help their employees with that, but it's also a lot of self-training. one of the main skills after COVID now that you have seen where CEOs separate themselves from the average CEOs and the outstanding CEOs is that the outstanding CEOs have shown to have a level of both empathy and compassion. And there are different things. Empathy is often to put yourself in the shoes of others, what you think someone else might experience. And that's an important thing you need sometimes, but that's not enough, nor do you always want to make your decisions by putting yourself in the shoes of everybody else. So it's difficult sometimes to guess, but you need a high level of empathy. But more importantly, CEOs that have compassion. Compassion is more about concern, about care, about feeling for, not feeling with the person. So it's that combination that separates them. Leaders that immediately went out there and changed their social contract with society, that immediately said, oh, we have had a blind spot. We are needing to have more people in of color in our company or different types of diversities that were excluded. Leaders that say, I have now my responsibility also to the value chain. It's the poorest, the most disadvantaged that I often don't see, but that are in my value chain that I have a responsibility for. Leaders that say, even if governments don't quite function, I need to step up, because ultimately businesses can only succeed in societies that succeed. It is my responsibility. I'm not only a citizen of this planet Earth, but by the sheer nature of being in a position of responsibility, I also need to portray my behavior and my actions to a broader group of people. And these are the leaders that are actually jumping out. And not surprisingly, their companies are also doing better.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the things that will help is figuring out ways, more and more ways, how to help some people who suffer from bad leaders. I often hear quotes, stories that I can hardly believe. People complaining about their own boss dominating others instead of helping others do what's right. Just received such a message from India. Yesterday received such a message from Brazil. It happens in Germany. It happens all over the place. And I think you've just alluded to some things we can do. One is having the real conversations. Having the real conversations, not just ticking processes. Yeah, there are leadership is measured in more and more companies, thank God. But in still too many companies, leadership is ticked as a process. And when I can tick the process, then I can demonstrate to my board, I've done it. No, you haven't. You have to have the real conversation. You have to really help a person grow. And that's something that I think is not yet happening to the extent that it needs to. Yeah? Although, to continue...
Interestingly, Stefan, in what you say, from obviously, we should not put judgments on others, what is a good or what is a bad leader. We often portray our own feelings in doing that. But if I look in my career, the people that have what I consider to be, by my standards, be bad leaders have actually helped me tremendously because they've made me what I think a better leader. It's only by looking at the behavior of others and reflecting the consequences of that in a positive or negative sense that you learn. So the bad leaders, I'm not advocating we need more bad leaders, but I am grateful that I've had some bad leaders in my career that have done the test of how you should not do it. Otherwise, I might have made the same mistakes. So it's the good leaders that we need to create more so than that we need to dwell on the bad leaders. The more we can invest in the young, in education, in when they come into companies, reach out and mentor people. I mentor 15, 20 people on a continuous basis. I mentor CEOs. The more we can generate this positive wave, the less do we have to deal with the negative.
Yeah, absolutely. And building on this, recently I had a great conversation with a company called Dreams in Details, a network of 12, 15 great people talking about leadership. And one of the thought was, Stefan, let's stop building this myth around the great leaders being the person, the individual. Let's stop talking leaders. Let's start talking leadership as a concept, because everyone needs to exercise leadership, young and old, anywhere in the world, an intriguing thought. And the other one is, I was recently invited earlier this year, I was invited to also be back in P&G and speak in a young audience in Frankfurt. And they asked me, Stefan, would you dare in a so-called fuck up night, would you dare sharing your biggest mistakes? And I immediately went in there and said, of course, my three biggest mistakes in my career, the black hole of assumptions, I assume too much. And some of those assumptions are just bloody wrong. The second one, the lack of consistently brutally honest self-reflection, And third, just I underestimated the power of connecting people with people and people with teams and themes. So these were my biggest three mistakes. And they go back to everything you say, and they go back to what I think we need to change to drive both the elimination of inequality, the climate, and the leadership we want on this planet. Yeah. Now, one of the things that I was very happy about earlier this year, I received a letter from my own bank, and I'm happy to say the name. It's UBS. And UBS told me, we are changing the criteria for fund investment. We are now investing not only into ESG, but also into leadership. And I went like, well, yes, finally someone acts. Finally someone with a huge lever directs investment into companies in your and my purpose. Yeah. So you are in touch with some of these people. You are maybe a member of boards. You are. So my question to you is, how can we make more big institutions with big levers invest into ESG and into leadership?
Well, the good thing, Stefan, it is starting to work because, there's obviously a moral reason why that is important. You know, ESG is not only taking care of your shareholders, but also of the planet, of the people that live off the planet, of their future generations. So running business in an honest, sustainable way and creating a better world. And it happens to be that COVID has shown us once more the enormous cost of failure. We've spent $12 trillion now globally just to stabilize these economies of the major fundamentally underlying problems. And that is where we need to focus on. But the interesting thing is that ESG during this crisis, the ESG funds have exploded, that more people are aware of where their money is going and they want it to go to building back a better future. They don't want to go back to further browning our societies and having to deal with pandemics every 3 to 5 years. We've had COVID now, or SARS, or Zika, or Ebola. This is a recurring pattern. So people want to build back greener. And it also happens to be that if we do that, we create more jobs, more resilient jobs, and better jobs. And the reason for that is we've waited so long that the cost of not acting now is higher than the cost of acting. So it's not only a moral obligation, but it actually has become a financially attractive. One of the reasons why Unilever had a 300% shareholder return or a 19% return on invested capital continuously, despite implementing the Sustainable Development Goals, is that because I believe, and I still do, that making this a better world for everybody is also actually a smarter way of running your businesses successfully. And so I think that is starting to happen. And interestingly, you mentioned UBS. UBS has just made a commitment to make 100% of their portfolio investments be sustainable. I've never understood why some of our major investors will say, oh, I have a fund here of 100 billion that is sustainable ESG, and the other rest of the money I invest is not. I always wonder, and I always have an urge to go to the discussions, that you feel happy investing not sustainably. These are good investments. These are bad investments. Yeah, and that differentiation that was there that you saw when the market was still immature is rapidly disappearing. People now understand that finance is one of the major drivers to create behavior change, but also to develop this better and greener economy that we need. And ultimately, it boils down to leadership. These are people that have these ideas. These are people that implement it at the high level, but also on the ground. These are people that resist against skeptics and cynics along the way who want to protect their vested interest. So at the end of the day, it is about people. I've said this world needs more leaders and trees, people that are driven by a strong sense of purpose that you need to build up that resilience, to be determined, especially in a world of more uncertainty. People who know how to cooperate with others. The problems are simply too big to do alone. People who can think intergenerational. Actually, not about yourself or your family or even here and now. It's actually making sure that many more people for generations to come can benefit from this planet. And then, you know, people that are obviously able to be systemic thinkers. The world is a complex place. People hide behind that complexity. Often it paralyzes us into action. But how can you get the leaders that can see this complexity, put their arms around it, distill it to simplicity and practical action steps? And these are the type of leaders that are going to do very well in the future. And the companies that they represent, I believe, will equally be better placed to be long-term successful.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Let me refer to the current time, this current year. 2020 has in many ways been a very particular year, a very special year, particularly driven by COVID-19 and the human crisis that it has caused. Now, at the same time, it has also accelerated change like never before, at least not in my life. Facts, between March and May, in 90 days, the e-commerce penetration on the planet increased by 11%. So in just 90 days, 11% of a big audience bought in the internet for the first time ever. The last time e-commerce penetration grew by 11 percentage points, it took 10 years. And now it worked in just 90 days. Or a big client of us, a publishing house, who needs 250 face-to-face client meetings per year to get the media investments into their business, suddenly struck. It comes March 10 and they can't meet their clients anymore. And rather than being paranoid for months, a wonderful woman who I just happened to know and work with took the lead and within 3 days built a Zoom-based or Teams-based environment that not only kept the business running, but now they meet 350 clients a year, 40% more meetings, more effectively prepared, more efficiently prepared. So she used this crisis as a way to accelerate rather than to be paralyzed. In what ways has this year, in what ways has COVID-19 influenced your thinking about the topics we are talking today?
Well, the what you are saying is right. On the one hand, COVID has actually accelerated some trends that were there, but we've probably done in 6 or 9 months what would have taken us 5 years. There's no question about it. But I think COVID has done more. It has shown us that you cannot have healthy people on an unhealthy planet. More people are now aware of the relationships between biodiversity, human health, climate, the economy, and actually the racial, social dimension has come to the foreground as well. So that higher level of awareness we need to seize upon to translate that into more purpose-driven action. And that is a change, and we've talked about that with ESG. The other thing is that if we are faced with an existential crisis, in this case, COVID, we can act very fast. And I think that is also something that we don't want to lose. And the other thing, the third element I want to mention is that we've discovered once more that we are connected. Perhaps we were living a little bit too much in isolation. It was interesting that we are all having 1 million likes on Zoom and or on social media, but we only have one real friend. I think in the COVID crisis has brought us all together again. Martin Luther King said it well when he said that we are inescapably, it's a network of mutuality, he called it, tied in a single garment of destiny. I think that single garment of destiny we've seen now, and it has brought us more together for the better. And it is clear that whatever affects one directly or indirectly affects many others as well. So hopefully we'll get a better level of multilateralism. We'll get a better cooperation again around these common issues to solve them. We will have a better awareness of the need to live in harmony with fellow citizens, with the planet Earth itself. And these are all great things that we need to nurture, that we need to cherish, and that we now need to grow in a bigger movement for change than we've done before. Unfortunately, in the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, we missed the opportunity. We spent a lot of money, but we spent it on the financial institutions, and people felt at the end of the day that banks were too big to fail, but people were too small to matter. And inequality kept going up, climate change kept going up, and it brought us to COVID. So now we have an opportunity to spend right, to behave right, and to create this world that we're proud about. And it's possible. Within the next 15 years, it's going to be instrumental, but it is clear that we can still get to a 1.5 degree global warming maximum, that it's actually at a lower cost than if we would not do it. It is also clear that we can create a new social contract where it's not just about the shareholder, where it's not about the primacy of the financial market, but where we make the financial market again subservient to the real economy and where we run the longer term multi-stakeholder models. This is the moment. The people that understand that, I think, will do very well. The ones that don't will be relegated to the graveyard of dinosaurs, I hope.
Thank you. Now we're coming to the end, Paul. And as I said, it's about 23,000 people in this call, maybe many more today. And unlike all the others, this time I would like to give you the final word. And before doing so, I'd like to first say thank you to you, my light bulb out there listening. And thank you very much to you, Paul, for taking the time to speak with us today about this important topic. It's very, very much appreciated. Thank you, Paul. And with that, I'd like to hand over to you for maybe a final question or a final perspective or a final advice on leadership or on any other topic that you would like to share with the Lightwolf community. Thank you, Paul.
Well, thank you, Stefan, and thank you for this wonderful talk. I always enjoy it, and I really appreciate what you are doing, and certainly also what your broad community of 23,000 people are doing. And indeed, at the end of the day, we have never been so forewarned about what is going to happen. We have never been so forearmed with tools to do something about it. And yet, collectively, we are paralyzed, it seems, at times, to deal with these issues of climate change, of inequality, of poverty, of hunger. And every day we wait, or every day we don't act to the level of our capabilities, someone in the world is going to suffer, someone in the world is going to die. And I think COVID has made that broadly to life. The ultimate ingredient to success is willpower. Do we really care? Because ultimately it is us as individuals in our circles of influence, in the broader circles that we might be able to deal with when we have higher levels of responsibility. It is up to us to drive the changes. And any time that we are aware of these issues, that we are in a position to do something about it, but we stay silent on the sidelines, we become bit by bit complicit. And you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that with the responsibilities you have to your own children or your families, to your colleagues at work, to your broader circle of friends, but more importantly, not to yourselves. We are all here on this wonderful planet because we have a little diamond inside of each and all of us that we need to let shine. And it is the combined brilliance of all these diamonds shining that makes the world function. I think we've all realized, especially the 23,000 people on this call, how lucky we are. I was born in the Netherlands, a little bit 10 years after World War II. My parents had a piece of bar soap at home, so I wasn't amongst the 4 million children that still die every year of infectious diseases. We had food at home, so I wasn't amongst the 800 million plus people that went to bed hungry or that ended up being stunted. I got free education from the Dutch government that I otherwise wouldn't have been able to support myself or my family to be educated, unlike many people in the rest of the world. So in fact, you could argue that we have won the lottery ticket of life. But the reality is, what did we do for it? Nothing. I was just lucky to be born here. So if you have won the lottery ticket of life, you actually only belong to about 5% of the world population. If you belong to the 5% of the world population, then it is your duty, your obligation to put yourself to the service of the other 95%. And if and when you do that, you will see the positive energy, the ripple effects that create the movement of change that ultimately will change this world to the better. And soon we will be in a situation that we can say we've implemented these famous sustainable development goals. We've created a world where we leave nobody behind, that we have irreversibly eradicated poverty in a more sustainable and equitable way. It is within our means, it is within our reach, it is within our capabilities, but it starts with us. Do we care? Do we have the willpower?
Great. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much, and lots of success, and obviously great holiday season for everybody, and be safe and have a fruitful, productive 2021.
Thank you very much, dear Paul.